everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, a special reflection on a person who meant so much to so many people, and he was also, in my case, a personal friend for a long time, Dick Gregory. Over the weekend, Dick passed. He was the age of 84, and I wanted to share some of the highlights of the interviews I had with him. Each of the interviews you're listening to during this program are from different shows. There were dozens of times he was on the air, and even more that we met, and he came down to my home in Florida, upstate, down in Texas. Yeah, he was a world traveler. He was a complex person. And towards the end of his life, I noticed, I hadn't been in touch with him in a while, but when I started to review some of his YouTube videos from college lectures, he had become, I believe, more bitter, more pessimistic. His answers were shorter. When asked about, you know, the ability to fight back against the demons of society, he said, why? You know, you're not going to win. In effect, you never win against these people. They control both parties, Democrats, Republicans, are equally corrupt. But Dick saw this a long time ago. But earlier in his career, he also was capable of doing something rather unique, having the wisdom of this universal mind. They could understand and interpret very complex issues and bring them into a place of humor where we could laugh at ourselves and society and also laugh at the irony of what he was showing. He always showed his irony. And he was a populist. He was a person of the people. I remember once we were walking down 125th Street to go get a juice. We started our walk on the Upper West Side and just kept walking and talking. We did this frequently, and I would listen more than anything because he might have been out engaged in some kind of effort, social issue, political issue, and he wanted to share his frustration, and he went into great depth about why systems don't change, and then why people don't change. And in some respects, he was a voice for the African-American, but he also was a voice for progressive people of all races and backgrounds. He looked at themes that were universal, not just topical and local. But he was also a pragmatist. He was not a utopian thinker. He never once had a conversation with me where he believed that things were going to become imminently better. And in this dialoguing, I would wait till he had finished, said what he had to say, and then I would offer back a different approach to the problem without becoming so disgusted that you just want to walk away from it. And this is something most people don't understand. All of these fighters, the people who are not hired or elected, they just choose based upon the veracity of not wanting to back off of a lie, a deceit, a conceit, a fraud, a failure of a system or people in it that we've trusted, he would face them. But he was also realistic. These people weren't going to change. They might change how they act and speak, as all politicians do, but that doesn't mean they're changing. He never saw any of these people change. And he was as critical of people within the African-American movement, especially some of its populist leaders, as he was people in other movements. He saw that they were exploiting the fear. And that became a big theme of Dick, about you control people through fear. And he would go into great depth in our discussions about here's the latest thing he was doing. And then back in the 1970s, he ran for president in 1966, didn't do very well, but at least he gave him a platform. And you didn't see his humor as much as you saw his insights, saying things that very few people were willing to say. Yes, Malcolm X would have said them, but Malcolm didn't have that capacity to make you laugh at the same time. And Martin Luther King had said them, But Dick said them frequently with this kind of irony, and you just couldn't help but just be stopped and think about it. He left you with a lot of issues that rolled around in your mind. But then he went on a rip, and every day he was traveling and lecturing. He had a phenomenally packed schedule. And occasionally he would end up on the major media, but not often. And more often than not, it wasn't as an individual guest, but rather on a panel. And then one day he called me, and he said, I want to get into health in a big way, and I don't quite know where to start. So we got together, and I gave him some insights and advice what to do. And he started. And he tended to take things at times to extreme. In fact, once he went on a fast that lasted nearly 90 days. That was way too long, way too dangerous, but that's where he lived. He lived right up against that third rail of contention. If someone had done 40, he was going to do double that. And he also was a part of that whole movement towards getting people to go vegetarian, go vegan. He was a major advocate. He wasn't earlier in life. And I believe that he would still be alive today had he grown up being healthier. But he's not alone in that. In fact, I was just speaking with Robert Houston today. And I hadn't spoken with Robert in a long time. And if you listen to the end of my program, you heard Robert, and I'm going to have him on for a full hour on this Progressive Commentary Hour in another week or two. Robert's a very quiet person, very self-effacing, but he's a deep thinker, and he's a real scholar. He spent over 25,000 hours of research finding the phytonutrients that are most important for rejuvenating the cells. And only now is he writing about it and coming on the radio for the first time in decades, probably 30 years, 35 years, and talking about it. I'll get back to Robert in a few moments because there's something he and Dick both had in common. But Dick was more than willing to come on at any time and share his insights, motivate people. He went to a couple of health retreats and came up to Grossinger's once, and always made people feel good. He never made you feel bad in his presence. You always felt that you were talking with a friend, not a celebrity. He never positioned himself as a celebrity. He positioned himself as just a person of the people. And that's what made him so endearing, because he made friends, not fans. Other people, Caucasian and African American, Latino and other cultures, once they become famous, they're, like it or not, they're elevated to a status of seeming so unique and so special and unreachable that you're just a fan and that's as close as you get. And unfortunately, then you surround yourself with sycophants and others who become nothing more than professional leeches. I've seen it time and again in Hollywood people. And he also saw it in Hollywood. In fact, when he went out to Hollywood once, he didn't have a place to stay. So I called a friend of mine who was a producer and a financier of films and one of the so-called A-list people, because he put the money up for films. And Dick stayed over at his place and had a great time and called me to tell me, man, these people are really dumb and superficial. I said, yeah. I said, and that's about as good as it gets. There are some bright people. There are some compassionate, sensitive, caring people in the community. Not all of them are, you know, dimwit, you know, people who just will do anything to get ahead. But unfortunately, those are generally the people you don't see. Those are the craftspersons, the cinematographers, the art directors, the composers, the people behind the scenes. But more often than not, the people in front of the cameras are these real prima donnas. These people who have overinflated egos, and immediately when they have their first success, everyone comes in and surrounds them and makes sure everything they want they have. You want drugs, they have every drug in the world for you. You want a man or woman to have sex with, they provide it. You want to go to all these parties, they have endless parties lined up for you and a chauffeured limousine to get you there. And all they're really doing is they're taking advantage. And then one day you don't do anything for yourself. Why should I go shopping? Why should I go to the cleaners, drop my clothes off? Why should I do anything? I've got my people who are doing it, not realizing whether it's agents or managers or lawyers or publicists or hangers-on or assistants. In a heartbeat, they'll call the National Enquirer and tell them anything and everything they know about you that could embarrass you or make it sensationalized about your personal life. And Dick had a chance to see this in the microcosm because of the fact that he was a guest at someone's home that had parties every night and all these people would show up. And Dick was, in his own right, a legitimate celebrity. And so he got to see how much these people were not real. And he told me, I'd be glad to get back to the streets of New York and see real people again. Anyhow, we were walking across 125th Street. We got over to a juice bar. And there's a very good juice bar over near 3rd Avenue on 125th Street. And I want to tell you, the people lined up to go over and shake his hand and talk with him. And he was just very patient. We must have spent an hour just answering people's questions. So from my perspective, Dick Gregory was just a really decent human being who felt the pain personally of all of the lies and deceptions and all of the manipulations and machinations that our society and special groups that make their living off exploiting people due to other people. And it didn't matter whether those people were white or black to Dick. He took on all these. But he had a way of taking all that energy in and then mixing it in his own emotional alchemy and bringing it back in his stories and his comedy routine in a way that I have not seen other comedians be able to do at the level of humor and interest and insight that he did. Others, Lenny Bruce could, Richard Pryor could. There have been some who could, and he was certainly in their ranks. But separately today, I was thinking about something that is important. And I'd like for all of us to just to reflect on this for a moment. The impermanence of life. The fact that everything we value in life, everyone that we value, will pass. That there's an expiration date on everything that we come into contact with and we value. And sometimes it's subtle things. The idea that you no longer have the same body you once had. And yet it didn't just change overnight. It changed slowly, and we adapted to it. I call that maladaptation to social issues. And we think about the relationship we're in and how special it is, if it's special, or how torturous it is, if it's torturous, and what it means to get out of it. And only when we're out of it do we suddenly have that capacity to exhale and take a deep breath and feel relieved as if a burden has been lifted and our energy is transformed. And you don't have to burn sage and wave it in the air for that negative energy to be gone. It's gone. But at the same time, what about all that positive energy, the things that we shared, the special moments, the remarkable moments, the tenderness, the joy, the humor, being ourselves, laughing, the absurdity of life that we mock and make fun of, and having someone who understood us enough to be in that moment with us. And then one day they're gone. And either they're not in our life, or they've passed. And think of the people who never thought that they would want to live without someone else, and now that person's divorced, gone, or dead. And there's nothing you can do in that moment except mourn. Now, you don't want to stay in perpetual mourning. That leads to depression and apathy. But also, you should never take anyone for granted. Just this weekend, after a year, I spoke with a person who keeps chronically busy. No matter what you ask, oh, my schedule is so packed. Oh, I got this, that, and the other. And I said, why do you put everything more important than your own life? Well, I got to overcome this, and I got to do that, and I got to... No, you don't. You've made your illness more important in your life, getting more degrees more important in your life, keeping busy more important in your life, making money, this is all based upon insecurity. what happens one day when you finally come up for air, when you finally feel safe enough that you can actually have a moment without rushing or feeling responsible to fill that void, and you realize, wow, what happened to everyone? Well, they went on. Everything goes forward. You just weren't around for that transition. And now you can't recapture that. And Thomas Wolfe was famous for you can't go home again. And that's a larger metaphor that as much as we'd like to go back and rekindle relationships because one or the other was not ready, wasn't the right time, they weren't mature enough, they weren't patient enough, they weren't understanding enough, they just weren't bright enough to understand what the other person meant to them or needed. Even if we could fulfill someone's needs reasonably and responsibly, we're not always ready for that. Sometimes we're just tied into our own needs so much we don't see the other person. And then they're gone. Now, maybe when you wake up and grow up, you think, wow, let me reconnect with that person. Never happens. Because they also have gone on. Everything in life goes forward. And we can't relive those moments. And a lot of times people live in their memory because their memory is far more remarkable in how they feel and exciting and how they feel than the moment they're in. And that's when we start seeing people feel very remorseful. If only. If only I'd have taken the time. If only I'd have spent more time. I remember once Virginia Reed, my friend, called me and she was crying inconsolably. And I said, what's wrong? She said, well, I got to take my dog to the vet. And I said, why? Well, the dog's in pain and can't really get up and go outside. And I got to carry him. And the vet said, it's best we just, you know, euthanize him. And I said, well, I can give you a protocol and get that dog's health back. I do that all the time. No, it's too much of a hassle. And so she went down, she euthanized the dog. And then she went into this deep sense of remorse. And so we went for a walk. And I said, what is your greatest pain now? And she says, the fact that I didn't spend quality time with the dog. I just assumed that it would always be there, and I made everything else, my career, my going out dancing every night, going to the dance parties up in the Catskills on the weekends, and I love my dog. I just didn't give it time, and when I was looking at its eyes at the very end, there was nothing I could say that would show that I had been selfish, and I'm sure that Virginia was not alone. Not everyone spends quality time with the people in their life. And especially today. Today when everything is a distraction. Where people don't feel comfortable sitting and looking at another human being. But feel more comfortable sitting and looking at a cell phone, an iPhone, or a computer. Internet friends that are really not friends. This whole depersonalized process. So when you have someone like a unique human being, like a Dick Gregory in your life, you better take advantage of it because the day comes when they're not there. When I came to the city, I was very young, and I was very blessed to meet some remarkable human beings, real Renaissance people, like the great artist Paul Swan. I was 22 when I first saw him, and he was performing a recital of Narcissist, and all the women in the room must have been in their mid-80s. He was in his mid-80s. And his pianist was a friend of mine and invited me. And I'm watching this old man. I saw him back behind this curtain in his Van Dyke studio. And his face was all cracked and deep ridges and jowly. And yet, just a moment later, when that piano started and his hand pulled the curtain back, he transformed himself. In fact, a person from Women's Wear Daily was there and gave a phenomenal review. And the women loved him. Everybody applauded him, and he was in his medium. And later, I would take him meals and get down and see how he was doing and got him his health back, got him about another 10 years onto his life. And I would sit there and just watch him work. And I remember one night, he looked over at me and he said, what are you looking at? I said, I'm just looking at you. He said, why are you looking at me? I said, well, it was raining, and there was a skylight, and the rain was hitting the skylight, and he was doing a portrait, and he was a sculptor, a poet, a playwright, a mime. He did all these wonderful things in his career, had a phenomenal career. But here he is, and I'm thinking, in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, he'll be dead. So I'm just going to burn that image of what it's like to be there. And I thought, how I could never meet someone like this where I grew up in West Virginia. And then there was Dr. Emanuel Ribisi and Dr. Linus Pauling and Dr. Abram Hoffer and others that I had a chance, who were much older, the grand feminist writer Sarah Dona, who was a radical feminist during the 1920s and 30s and 40s and 50s. So the lesson to learn is, let us not just mourn people when they die and try to remember remarkable moments, but let's appreciate them when they're alive. Let's unclutter our life to the point where we can actually spend quality time with people that we care about. I'm just thinking now, today, people who are remarkable in their intellect, their creativity, their personality, who have passed just recently. Dean, who's a good close friend of mine over at Fairleigh Dickinson University, Ron Calusi. And I remember telling Ron when he drove me back, he'd drive me over and back from my teaching over there. And I said, Ron, you've got to lose weight. Come down and detox. Come spend a month down in my home. I'll get there. And never got there. And then Neil Kramer. Now, some of you remember Neil. He's a really good-looking guy. He was a lawyer from Columbia University. And he was my lawyer for years. And we traveled throughout the world together. And he'd come and host a lot of the events and up at him and Adria Eismeyer, up at the HOMOAC and the Concord and the Granite and Grossinger's. And he was very personable. Everybody liked Neil. He passed recently, just this year. And Marty Feldman and Virginia Reed and George Marcus and Tom Croft and Ron McCauley. And these are personal friends, but then professional friends like Mitchell Gaynor and Nicholas Gonzalez and many others. So all of us should pause and say, let me never again take a person's friendship or relationship for granted. If I am their friends and I have a moral, spiritual responsibility to let them know I'm there and to engage, because everything else will be there. Your work will be there, your responsibilities will be there, but that person may not. And that's what I want to leave you with on this issue. Now, I'm going to play some clips now, but at the end, I'm coming back, and if any of you had any relationship with Dick Gregory or any stories that you know personally about Dick Gregory you'd like to share, I'll leave a little room at the end for you to share those on our talkback segment. Our number is 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. And just a final thought, when I was doing Black Hollywood, the history of African American or Negro in motion pictures, which was the first book about this deep history, I had spent 7 years working at every day doing my research in Harlem at the County Cullen and Schoenberg Collections and meeting African-Americans who were retired and just living their lives, but they had been part of that system. And then they said, well, here's where you can find Rex Ingram or, you know, Paul Robeson or Lena Horne or any whoever was still alive. And that was invaluable. And when Dick read the book, he says, tell me about the stories of these people, the stories you couldn't put in the book. And I'd spent hours talking about the Black Valentino, Lorenzo Tucker. He was considered one of the most handsome African-American actors in history. And you see pictures of Lorenzo Tucker and the great film historian, Miles Kruger, and on my website. And I have the Anita Bush, the first African-American to appear in motion picture. You see that. Dick was fascinated by all this. And he was fascinated by the scholarship it took just to spend the time day after day after day when you're not making any money. You're doing it as a passion of love. But he also wanted to meet some of those people, so I gave him their information, and he visit him because he also wanted to know what it was like to be in a highly racist community, the Hollywood community, back in the 1920s, teens, and 30s and 40s. So take nothing for granted. Really embrace the relationships you have. Show appreciation to the people in your lives, because the day will come when all that we value will be gone. And let us hope then that we have lived a life of value, so we do not feel that deep sense of pain when someone who is close is gone. Now we're going to go to those clips from Dick Gregory and from our archives. I have a lot. I wanted to select some that just, and each one's different, to give you an idea of how he was thinking and what he shared on different issues. Now we'll go to Dick Gregory.
In your humor, I notice that you make things very personal. You keep directing people back, yourself back, to the sources of what something evolves from. Therefore, you show the absurdity of our actions. And I'd like for you to share a lot of that with us now.
One of the things that, when I first started in show business, I used to come out with a cigarette in my hand. And the cigarette was the prime thing of my act, you know, smoking and my timing. Now I come out with a glass of water. I come out with a glass of water. And it's amazing that across this country, I can walk out and say, how much water? And you're going to hear the drummer say, eight ounce glasses of water a day, you know. And then I go and talk about the body, you know. And, you know, you mentioned something very interesting about the meat, the animal it comes from. And I do this whole thing about, you know, I'm talking to this black dude, and he said, well, how come you're vegetarian? I said, well, I'm a vegetarian because it's healthy. Well, how you get your proteins? And I do the thing I did the other day, that one of the things when I'm dealing with black folks, I don't like to talk to black folks about nutrition, because all at once they know more about it than me. And the protein things are good. Well, you need proteins. I said, yeah. Then I said, you know, there's a lot of proteins in a steak. Well, that's what I'm talking about, brother. I said, but you know, cows don't eat steak. And then the bell rings. Boom. You know, and so if you put the right minerals, the right vitamins, get the proper rest and proper exercise, your body will manufacture everything you need. You don't have to eat hair to grow hair. You don't have to eat kneecaps to grow kneecaps. You don't have to eat fingernails to grow fingernails. And it's so this type of, and when we talk about African Americans, trust me, there is no diet on this planet that's as bad as the African American diet. Now, you have a conflict there, because people say, well, if we're eating so bad, how come I'm alive? No, you think you're alive. You see, I grew up not seeing anything wrong with a headache, not seeing anything wrong with being sick all the time. I thought that was part of life. Not until I got into health and nutrition did I realize you're not supposed to get sick. All these are warnings. And so consequently, when I sit back now and I look, if you put eight-ounce glasses of water, if you eat more fruit and eat more raw food, if you get the proper rest and the proper exercise, one of the things I do in the show, I say, and y'all be sure and walk. So, well, I got a bad leg. Walk bad. Walk the same way you walk when you're going to get a lottery ticket or when you're going to the liquor store. Get your exercise. And the interesting thing is, you see, my mother, all the people that loved me exposed me to the bad stuff, and they wasn't doing it to punish me. I mean, this was my reward. If you got an A, you get a candy bar. And so all at once now, and it's beginning to work. Let me tell you the hardest thing we have in this society, and the people who run it and control it know this, that repetition. My children didn't call me daddy because they was born understanding the word daddy. They heard it said over and over from their mama, daddy, daddy. I walked in the house when they heard one of my children calling the broom daddy. But when they finally zero and call you daddy, your response to it, but they heard the word over and over. It's interesting. This show, how many times can this show repeat over and over? All this genius material you have, but commercials repeat over and over and over. That's the only thing when I turn on, I hear repetition over and over and over and over. It's Coke, is it? Da-da-da-da. Pepsi's it? Da-da-da-da. And so when I hear this over and over, and we got to understand the human mind, the brain is like a computer. They haven't invented nothing. They're talking about the information highway. I'm the information highway. Me and you sitting across talking to one another, we ain't got no wires hooked to us. I'm the information highway. You're the information highway. And so when we understand how this whole repetition work over and over. Now, what happens to minorities and the reason I died is so bad that We look for treats. We're not aware of it. We look for treats. And let me tell you something. A 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 year old black child has more money than a 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 year old white middle class child. And the reason for that is this. I'm poor, black, uneducated, got a job I go to every day. Don't pay that much, but it's a job. And when I have a child born, I don't have the luxury or even the whereabouts to know to get another insurance policy on me. I don't have an insurance policy in my job to cover my child. I don't have the money to cover them going to college. I know they're going to get through high school. And so that's as far as my limit go, because this whole college thing, I'm told you need money to go to do this. I can't help my child do math and trigonometry. I can't even spell it. And so consequently, what I can do is when I walk in and look across and see you, my son, I can reach in my pocket and give you $5. And that cancels out something in my, and I see that smile come on. So you got little black children that go to the little candy store on the way to school that will spend. I know a guy in Cleveland that owns a confectionery that do $6,000 every morning in penny candy. I mean, do you know there's some people on South Fifth Avenue? Oh, I mean, on Fifth Avenue, that cannot say that they can constantly year-round have that type of income coming in the morning. And that's those joys and those treats that we reach out and cancel out this debt. Same thing happens in a bar. I did an experiment with a white friend of mine once. I said, I'm going to take you to a black bar, and we're going to sit there. And then I'm going to leave, and I'm going back to the hotel. And I'm going to leave you there, and I want you to call me when you start feeling white. And we'll take him to this black bar in Chicago. And we sit there, everybody, hey, Brother Greg, how you feel? Hey, meet my man Art, blah, 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 blah. And then I leave him. And he calls me about an hour and a half later. Man, how did you know? I mean, and he was brilliant enough to know that he didn't become white just because I left. You know, what did I do wrong? Well, when I go as a black to a bar and I order a drink, and when they bring me my drink, I pay them and right then, and then I leave a tip. Whites go, they sit the money on, and they just keep pulling the money out, and at the end you leave a tip. I cancel out my debt. It's one of the few debts I can cancel out, and I cancel out the debt. So black bartenders and black barmaid make 500 times more than a white bartender and white barmaid, because remember, every time I order a drink, you follow me, I pay for it. Okay, it's one of the few times I can cancel out a debt. And so when you look at what a system where oppression comes from, little treats. So when I go out looking for something sweet in life, there's a craving. Now, when you talked about that craving that you have, I have that craving plus another one. I have something in my life that's telling me I'm craving something sweet. That sweet is not sugar. That sweet is freedom. That sweet is getting a universal respect for who I am, for my now. You know what it's like to come up in a system, and every now and then you hear folks over here saying genetically they're not as smart as white folks, but then they never tell you about England. And in London, in England, but London particularly, like we know how high test scores the Chinese make and Asians make in America. In London, the Africans do that. You know, it has nothing to do with genetics. It has something to do with a culture pattern. And so my culture pattern is being overprotected. Just mommy's little baby. Mommy knows something going to happen to me when I walk out in that street. And so she gives me something to cancel it out. Here's some candy. That's not the sweetness that the God is telling me that I need. And that's what we looked at the Million Man March. We looked at the Four Seasons Hotel was sold out a month before the march. The Ritz-Carlton. You couldn't land a private jet in Washington, D.C. because all those spaces was full. Those wasn't Africans coming in from Europe. Those was black Americans coming in. It was about hurt. If Colin Powell becomes president of the United States and he comes to Manhattan today without those white bodyguards, he cannot get a cab. If Clarence Thomas, most powerful judge system in the world, Supreme, if he come to New York with his robe, he's not going to get a cab. They know that. And so that pain, something very interesting that most of the researchers haven't been able to figure out. And that is, why is it that out of all the bad habits that poor, poverty-stricken youth have, smoking is not one of them. I mean, 85% of your youngsters smoking cigarettes are white, and they hadn't figured it out. And then they come up with some silly reason. Here's what the reason was, that the reason white folks smoke is, and this was a black come up with this reason when they asked him why. He said, well, white folks smoke because smoking cigarettes is so bad it helps keep your weight down. I said, give me a break. Black children don't smoke because oppression I have, I'm looking for instant gratification. Candy gives me instant gratification. Kool-Aid gives me instant gratification. That new outfit gives me instant gratification. When I smoke that and it burns my throat, I don't get instant gratification. When I drink that alcohol for the first time, I don't get instant gratification. And that's the difference, that you don't see the marijuana level and the drug level and the experimenting with acid at a young level. It's because I'm looking. Now we tie that right into food. Now, why do we have more young black males die in New Year? I mean, in America, in 1 year from asthma than all the asthma deaths around the world. Okay? We don't drink water. One of the things that we do is Kool-Aid, lemonade, Gatorade. I mean, this body was not put together with AIDS. This body was put together 97% liquid and 85% of that is water. Water, water. But I'm looking for something sweet. I'm looking for something that gives me instant gratification. And this is what we have to begin to start overriding. And then you start seeing that change. And I thank you. Here's the documents. You come up with the document that we need to go in. And now with the new information, with the tape, because it's one thing that nobody you find in right mind is against nutrition, is against being healthy. They just don't know what nutrition is. I mean, you would assume when you go to a major hospital and they say, well, the dietitian is going to fix your food, you would assume. I had a black friend of mine that's one of the foremost heart and brain surgeons in the world, and he told me at Johns Hopkins Hospital, he brought me in to speak, and he said, you know, one of the sad things is when I operate on these rich folks' hearts, and one of them looked at me and says, you know, when I looked at my food when I came out of anesthesia, the same food that put me here is what they brought up. You know what he told him? He says, I know that, but we have no control over the kitchen. That's a separate section of the hospital. I can come in. I can operate. I can give you a heart transplant. I can operate on your heart, but I have no control over what comes up out of that kitchen. And so this is the dilemma that we in. And black folks is in a double dilemma because of that instant gratification. But let me say this to you, my brother. It's beginning to change. I mean, if you go around to the black expos, you start seeing literature now. You start seeing nutrition literature now. You start seeing more black folks is going into the health food, going into the herbal shops. I mean, black folks is talking herbs now, and it's beginning. But, you know, it's like a jet plane that's traveling 900 miles an hour. You better not dare try to turn it around. Immediately you'll crash, and that's where we're going now. I hear black folks saying, well, I'm going to eat me some of this old bad barbecue. If I heard my mother put a disclaimer in front of barbecue as a child, I wouldn't have tried it. And that's where we got to really put some emphasis. Don't give up on the older folks, but we got to put emphasis on the children. And one quick example I'll give you, out of all the ways people commit suicide, especially in my age group, 60, and I'm not saying 60 commit suicide, I'm talking about people that commit suicide, they don't drink iodine. I mean, you telling me, man, it is easier to go up 50 stories in a hotel and jump out the window than drink some iodine. Why? Because as a child, I didn't see people committing suicide. I didn't hear nobody talking about it. But as a child, I saw the skeleton and the crossbone. And maybe if we put little sugar bags out with skeleton and crossbones on them and say to the older folks, if you're going to drink coffee, if you're going to do all these things around young folks, let's put it in a bag with a skeleton and a crossbone.
You meet in the general population because you meet people of all races, but younger as well as older people are motivated by fear or as a deterrent. In other words, if you smoke, you're going to get cancer. If you eat this food, you're going to get overweight, harm your heart. Or do you find that they need something else to motivate
them? They're being motivated by fear and information. Okay, fear will motivate me for a few minutes, and then after that headache leave, you know, I'll go back to that sweet potato pie, that apple cobbler. but it's the information. And so and so between the fear and the information, I mean, I don't have to tell you this, but it might be someone in the audience. 2/3 of the American people last year tried alternative medicines. OK, that's out of fear and information, because just the fear don't tell me about alternative medicine. It's the information that's out there. I looked at a report the other day, and doctors' income last year was down for the first time in like 100 years. And it's just people's looking for something now, and it's out there.
Dick, if you were president of the United States, what would be some of the things you would change from the media's perception to our healthcare medical system, to our environmental issues? What would you see as the way that change could occur or should be?
Well, one of the first things you have to do is de-ignify. By that, I mean, we didn't get this way just because we want to be this way. We've been duped. And they've built the first nuclear reactor to give us energy was built in the state of New York in Indian Gap. And to convince the whole world and everybody in that area that nuclear pieces were free, nuclear, nuclear reactors that they give us, the SIPs or two for electric, to convince us that they were safe. They built a school right across from it. You know, well, we got so much information now, that could never happen. Now, if I was president of the United States, the first thing I would do is stop this horror. You see, what they're fixing to do is terrorize everybody with this whole welfare piece, and then you paint it black, and while everybody's looking at the welfare piece being painted black, they do all these other things. First, I'll give you some information as president of the United States. First, I was born and raised on welfare. 80% of welfare mothers have never produced a child that was on welfare. You know, Harvard Business School should have those odds. And when you stop and look, welfare mothers in America have 1.5 babies per mother, and married women have 5.9. My wife has 10. You know, so let's get this whole myth out of our head. But food stamps. Let's look at food stamps for a minute. When I was a youngster, we didn't have food stamps. And then one day we did have food stamps. And all of us on welfare was happily surprised because we did nothing to get food stamps. That was your major chain stores, Kroger's, A&P, your Safeways, and all of those stores was the one that got food stamps. One of the problems that I would straighten out as president of the United States, I mean, this is my first problem I would deal with, is one, we need to change welfare. There's a lot of things that's wrong with welfare. But why are we so nasty to the people that's getting it? My God, if when they found out that these large corporations had duped these women, had put them on all kinds of drugs and medication that created problems, and when they said, we're going to rectify, you never saw them go after these corporations with the meanness and the nastiness. And let me tell you something, as President of the United States, the day would end when we live in a country where we recycle a can but won't recycle a wino. Trust me, they won't recycle our elderly folks. Trust me. Now, I would keep food stamps out there, but with food stamps, you could only buy fresh fruit, fresh vegetables, beans, rice, bread, basic staples, and I put dairy products in. Against my better judgment, I wouldn't be ready for that big fight of them guys. I'd get them later. And all at once, you would see this thing turn around. We would talk about education. We would talk about a federal jail where they can smoke in jail. Give me a break. I mean, I wipe out your whole family. I go to jail for the rest of my life. I can smoke in jail. And while I'm smoking in jail, I get cancer. And the one of the family members I miss, your tax money going to pay for my cancer? Give me a break. You can't have cocaine in jail. I'm not talking about what slips in. You can't have beer in jail. Why do we let them have cigarettes in jail? And I would, if we give farm subsidy, I would have no problem with giving a subsidy to the tobacco growers as they go through this transition period, because I would come off cheaper giving them a subsidy not to plant than I'm coming out now with all the sicknesses and the disease. And as I said in the show the other night, the number one killer in America. It's not drive-by shootings. Someone killing cigarettes. 495 million Americans die every year from smoking cigarettes, which represent
490,000.
I'm sorry, 490. Thank you. 495,000 people die every year in America from smoking cigarettes. That's 19% of the deaths. Second highest cause of death is bad diet and inactivity. That's 300,000. That's 14% of death. Third is alcohol, 100,000. That's 5% of death. Well, what about illegal drugs and drive-by shootings? Illegal drugs is 1%, and firearms is 2%. So while you're locked in the house, scared to come out, worrying about a drive-by shooting, smoking your cigarettes, eating your barbecue ribs, not doing no exercise, and drinking your whiskey, you're participating in the top three killers. And so as the President of the United States, I have a fantastic effect and belief in the human spirit if you give them the right information. And I'd be an information president. I would first tell you where all these tests, do you know 243 cities, they have dropped germ warfare testing. And one city in particular is San Francisco. They dropped a germ warfare experiment that protected the respiratory system. They keep saying it didn't really have no effect, but respiratory death by respiratory disease in San Francisco since then have increased something like 85%. And once you put all of this out and let the people see it and say, look, not to scare you, but to correct this and see to it that this will never...
From the General Accounting Office study of the FDA, quote, 37 of 49 top officials of the Food and Drug Administration who left the agency moved into high corporate positions with the large companies they had regulated, unquote. Your thoughts on this, Dick Gregory?
Well, you know, we're looking at one phase of it, the milk. We have that happening in every form of life. Every form of the industry that's supposed to be regulated for our protection and is really regulated for the big business protection. I'm going to call Dr. Epstein and give him another little project. It's kind of interesting. If you check around the world where we have crib death all over the world, you find out where there is no cow's milk, there is no crib death. And one day when we realized the number one ingredients in milk that humans need is not called calcium, it's called casein. And cow's milk has 300 times more casein in it than mother's milk because cow's milk has to build a bone structure to carry a ton plus and double the weight of the calf within like 3 to 4 weeks. Mother's milk has enough casein in it to build a bone structure to carry maximum 175 pounds and double the weight of that child within 8 to 9 months. Now, what do they make? What's two products offshoot that they make with casein? They make kerosene from casein and they make glue. Now, one day we're going to have to ask ourselves a question. Is it an accident that the number one milk company in the world, Barton's Milk, just happened to make Elmer's glue? Or do they know something? And one day I feel when we get down to the real research, we'll find out it's this gluey substance that some babies can throw off and some can't. And this is what causes that smothering and suffocation. And I think once we look into that, but in every walk of life, you know, listen, I've been hearing all my life that black children have a high amount of lead poisoning because they eat the paint. Listen, I am 64 years old. I have 10 black children, 5 black grandchildren. I've been married to a black woman for 37 years, and I have never heard nobody, and out of all the black folks I know, ever heard a conversation, you know, I came home today, and Billy and them had ate all the paint off the wall. I mean, out of all the black folks, out of all the things I've ever heard in my life, I have never heard one black say to another black, I just have to do something with Junior and Mary. Every time I leave home, I come back, the pain is gone. You know, trust me. Now, we eat popcorn, jelly beans, Kool-Aid. There are no black children eating paint. Believe me. I mean, even if you ate paint, you know, a child's very interesting. If you eat it, you know, you can't get a child to eat honey. Child eats honey, something comes up. And they start. You leave jelly beans and chocolate and honey and leave them with some children and come back, the honey will be there. Okay? Now, trust me, when you put paint in your mouth, that paint off the wall. And so one day we're going to have to find out what is causing the high amount of lead.
All right, folks, we continue our post-election analysis, talking to our with our Wisdom of the Elders segment. And so we had Reverend Jackson on Monday, Clarence Jones, MLK's attorney on Tuesday, joining us today, civil rights activist, comedian Dick Gregory. How you doing, my brother?
I'm fantastic. Having fun.
Absolutely.
Feel good.
This path forward. Yes. Folks are apoplectic, upset, mad, angry.
Anytime you vote for the lesser of the two evils, you evil yourself. That's how Hitler came to power. Okay? We don't see that. But you got to be evil. Here's a guy who rapes a woman once a month, another guy rapes a woman once a day, and you got to pick one to babysit for you. You're evil. And that's what America, that's how Hitler came to power. See, few people know Hitler won that election by 288 votes. Okay? And almost wiped the world out. So you can get by with that with the church, but you can't get by with that with the universe that made the moon, the sun, and the stars. And that's where we are.
You got people who are concerned in terms of where do we go from here.
You don't go nowhere. It's not your business. Not your business. If you ever saw Trump's television shows, brilliant. So how do you get so stupid all at once? If I went to apply for a job collecting garbage, they would ask me to bring in my last year's tax return. You run for president, you don't have to bring his in, and y'all tolerate it and don't know where it's going? That's what it's about. That's what it's about.
What do you say to that activist, to that young person, to that elder who's saying, okay, what do I do for the next 4 years?
You can do nothing. You're not going to make 4 years. This country won't make 4 years. It's over.
Now, when you say it's over, what does that mean?
It means decline. The Romans, the Greeks, the Egyptians, all of them fell. Okay? All of them fell. You see it.
So what should we do? Because Jim over here talks about the resistance.
Please.
They had a resistance with even going against Hitler.
Please. The Jews didn't know what Hitler was doing. Okay? Our problem is we think we're part of this government, and you're not.
Yes, sir.
We want to take the Democrats and Republicans, but when Condoleezza Rice came in, she had more PhDs than the whole administration had, and they called her Condi. They never called Madam Maddie. There's a soda pop darker than her called Dr. Pepper. If you go get one, you better call it by its title, or they give you a chili pepper. That's what it's about.
We are. You look at the people who he's already putting on his transition team, and it's amazing to me watching mainstream media lose their mind. Oh my goodness! Oh my goodness! And I'm sitting there going, he made it clear what he said during the campaign, what he was going to do. Why y'all acting shocked now?
Yeah, but my mother was the same way. She went to the doctor and she said, if you find cancer, don't tell me. That's what white Americans do. If you find it, don't tell me. They didn't just get like that all at once. You got high school students marching, huh? The question needs to be asked, how y'all leave school with no permit, huh? Because if you had a child on one of those marches and they got killed by a car, the school got to pay you. That's not the easy thing to do. But they did, huh? Marched by the White House, marched by, and nobody saying anything? Principal told them to go out and demonstrate in the playground? Everything you're seeing, something's wrong with it. Okay, something's wrong with it.
Do you think that we're going to continue to see more of these protests? They've been happening every single day all across the country.
Yeah, because most of them are staged. Most of them are staged. You know, I've been protesting all my life. I got 10 children, 13 grandchildren. They just don't get up one morning and say, I'm going to demonstrate. The easiest thing in the world is find out what a child going to do because they talk. I mean, we're stupid enough in America to believe the Ku Klux Klan determined public policy. Most of them can't read. Most of them can't write. And when I got ready to run away from slavery, the sheriff going to ask me for my letter from Gotcha P. I just take any letter because they couldn't read. Show it to them. This is what this is about. But we so filthy ourselves. I spent millions of dollars walk out with my life. I got to go too. I'm just as dirty as they are. When I get on a plane next week and go to Budapest, round trip, first class, $42,000. I pay tax on that, which buys bullets, which drop on little children. So when they fall on your children, why are you upset?
That's just some of the clips. We have more of those clips in our archives, lots more. And that final clip showed the difference in his approach in the last year of his life. And that clip was, I saw the last interview that he did. It was very bitter. It was almost bordering on acrimonious, and there was no humor in it. There was no irony in it. It was just kind of an angry man looking back on his life and seeing how little people have evolved away from racism, stereotyping, identity politics, and biases. So I don't know what was in his mind when he passed, but I know that he would have loved to have had another lifetime to see if a different approach might have made a difference. And by the way, you can credit Dick Gregory, even with his hyperbole, even though he wasn't a scientist, never pretended to be. He didn't have any background in nutrition. So his figures were, his generalizations were interesting, though the specifics were clearly not always accurate. But he made his point. And sometimes it's not the scientist, it's not the academic, it's not the professor, it's not the person that's very specific and scholarly that moves people. It's a person who can register in someone's mind, this isn't right. Pay attention to it. You're a fool. You've been duped. And Dick was a master of that. And once he got into health, and he did get into health in a big way, he lectured all across America to the African-American community, and he caused millions of African-Americans to question what they were doing. Now, how many actually changed because of that, we don't know. But he sure did make a great effort, more than anyone else I know in the African-American community. He influenced people and taught people about juicing, veganism, the dangers of sugar and preservatives, and also not trusting those scientists and doctors and nutritionists and government officials who with absolute certainty tell you what to eat that ends up killing you. So Dick Gregory will be missed for a lot of reasons. We're going to end with some music that I know Dick would appreciate to see him on his way.
Let me hear the worshipers! Belong to God. Here we go.
Every praise
is to our God.
Every word of worship.
With one accord.
Every praise.
Every praise.
Every praise
is to our God. Come on, everybody.
Sing hallelujah.
To our God.
Glory, hallelujah.
Praise.
Say every praise.
It's to our God.
Y'all know how we do it. Take it up.
Every praise.
It's to our God.
Every word of worship.
With one accord.
Come on, say every praise.
Every praise.
It's to our God.
Be missed, my friend, by all of us. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.